We turn to Titus chapter 1. Titus. Titus chapter 1. Okay, Titus chapter 1, reading from verse 10 to 16. It says, "For there are many insubordinate, both idle talkers and deceivers, especially those of the circumcision, whose mouths must be stopped, who subvert whole households, teaching things which they ought not for the sake of dishonest gain. One of them, a prophet of their own, said, 'Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons. This testimony is true. Therefore rebuke them sharply, that they may be sound in the faith, not giving heed to Jewish fables and commandments of men who turn from the truth. To the pure, all things are pure, but to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure, but even their mind and conscience are defiled. They profess to know God, but in works they deny Him, being abominable, disobedient, and disqualified for every good work.'" So read God's word before we come to the we come to study number 4 in this series on the Christian in the Chinese culture. Remember that we are not catering only for the Chinese but also for others. So we are not experts in other cultures, but at least you know how the principles are applied, and then you can consider your own culture. And also some of us might think that this is not relevant. We are Christians and we don't have to bother about the culture we are in. You are badly mistaken, I have to say, and you are not going to go very far serving the Lord if you have adopted that type of attitude. So we must be compassionate, we must be understanding of people who are from such a culture. When they are new believers, they have to struggle very much adjusting to their culture. Then for older believers, we want to be more useful as the days go by. One missionary who came to know the substance of these studies which were put into book, he said that he wished he had known the content of this book earlier in his ministry as a missionary. It would have helped him very much when he was a missionary in China. Those were in the days when, well, in the early days and before the recent advances in China and so on. So this evening we come to consider three factors that bind the Chinese. In the passage we have read, Titus chapter 1, we learn that the Cretans in Paul's time had developed certain cultural characteristics that were not very flattering. So also, compared to the Cretans in Paul's day, we would have to say that Chinese also have, down the centuries, developed their own culture to such an extent that not everything is nice and beautiful, not everything is good. And in the history of writings on the Chinese, there are Chinese people themselves who laugh at themselves, you know. Really, they write negative things about themselves, and have, obviously with tongue in cheek, you can search that out, you know, they are available. But there are others who would tend to defend the culture and see everything as bright and good. But we want to be honest, and we know that in every culture there are the good and the bad. So good practices, bad practices, good values, bad values. See? So a person from the background of the Chinese religion will face tremendous struggles when confronted by the claims of the Bible. So even when the gospel first come to the person, he might have to struggle because of various cultural influences. See? So if not for the irresistible grace of God in Jesus Christ, no Chinese will be converted. And of course, we can say the same for people of other cultural backgrounds. But what we want to take note of here are the Chinese people. What are the peculiar factors that hinder the average Chinese from yielding his life to Jesus Christ? So I point out three hindrances which are discernible. What are they? One is pietism, the second is maxims, and the third is materialism. So let us go through each of these in turn. First, we consider pietism. By pietism is meant a strong sense of loyalty the average Chinese feels towards his religion, family, and clan. Now, this strong sense of loyalty might be conscious or unconscious. Some people knowingly read more, discuss more, talk more about this subject, so they are more conscious of it. Others grew up being interested in other things, and along the way they just grow up, you see, and they are unconscious that they have absorbed certain values molded by their culture. And we know that the Chinese religion has been passed down from generation to generation. It's a long history. We have noted that it is an ancient civilization that has been unbroken. The written language or the written history of China stretches back 4,000 years, and the oral history stretches back another 2,000 years. So you can imagine that for an ancient civilization that has remained unbroken, it has been conquered, but the people get absorbed because of the superior culture, and they therefore did not disrupt the culture, they did not change the way of life and thinking of the people, but the culture had continued for thousands of years. And therefore, for the average Chinese in any period of time, you discover that he will be influenced knowingly or unknowingly by his cultural values, and there are various factors that affect him. And we would say that because of this long history, they tend to hold to what they believe in, what they practice, without thinking. It's accepted, it's the norm, it is the thing that we have been doing, not only for this generation, but for past generations. So we say tradition dies hard. So for the Chinese, we know that the Chinese religion is made up of three main influences. There is Confucianism, the teaching of Kongzi or Confucius. He basically taught the people to respect the elders, and he believed in the importance of family unity. And his teaching resulted in the practice of reverencing the elders being carried over to worshipping those who are dead. Confucius himself did not teach people to worship the dead, but because of reverencing the elders, they extended it in practice to those who are dead. And the other influence was Taoism. Lao Tzu, who started Taoism, he was a philosopher, and he contributed to the mystical aspect of the Chinese religion. There are good spirits, there are bad spirits. You learn to read the weather, and you learn to predict what might happen. And so the occult also comes in. So philosophy mixed with the occult, and it gives to the mysticism of the Chinese religion. Then Buddhism came from India in the first century AD. It was sometimes accepted by the emperor, sometimes rejected, and there was no continuous official acceptance of Buddhism. But nevertheless, Buddhism was accepted by the ordinary people, and today Buddhism has been there, the influence has been there for a long time. It influenced especially the literature, the classics, which we have looked at in our previous studies. And I mention this in order to show the various strengths of influence. And because Buddhism has had such a tremendous influence, especially on the literature, you discover that the values that we're talking about come across and mix with Confucianism, where reverencing the elders and reverencing the dead comes in, and mix with mysticism of Taoism, you discover that all this has an effect on the pietism of the Chinese. And many families of the same surname would constitute a clan. They can be of diverse dialects depending on where they live in that vast land of China. So you can trace your own ancestry if you are Chinese, and you discover that the clan has spread throughout China, and today you speak different dialects. The dialects are so diverse that you might not understand one another, but the written language is the same. So in by writing, then you can understand one another. Otherwise, speaking to one another, sometimes the dialects are so diverse that it's hard to or impossible to understand one another. Other dialects are close to one another, so they can make up what each other is saying. Okay? And what happened is, as an example, in a talk like this, I can just give some personal examples. In writing, I wouldn't want to put this down, you see. So for my family, we stretch back to about 10 to 12 generations in the Santou, in the Guangzhou province. And our dialect is quite different from the normal Cantonese. And the reason is because our ancestors in Santou, the Santou is located at the border with the other province, Fujian. So the Caozhou dialect is closer to Fujian. So the Fujian people can understand the Caozhou people, the Caozhou people can understand the Fujian people. See? But the Caozhou people, if they have not learned Cantonese, they would not understand the common Cantonese, even though it's in the province of Guangzhou. See? And the history goes that there was an emperor who decided to carve off part of Fujian province and gave it to Guangzhou. That was why that part of Fujian became part of Guangzhou, although the dialect is closer to the Fujian. So our ancestors can trace back to Santou in Guangzhou for about 10 to 12 generations. Then earlier than that, they were in Fujian province, and that they were there longer, probably for 16 to 20 generations. So, then earlier than that, they were actually from the north. Our clan actually were from the north next to Shantung province. There is another prophet province, and the ancestral village is actually there. Yeah. So we migrated south, as our clan migrated south and then interact with the southern people. Of course, we picked up the southern dialects. Yeah. But characteristics of the people on and off show up. For example, certain the peculiarity of the eyebrows, the thick eyebrows with the edges sticking out among the old people especially. Yeah. The square face, we say, the Chinese character for Guo, the country. See, the faces tend to be like that, longish. And then the men tend to be tall. You see, I'm only average, but you see the people of my clan, they are generally big size and tall. You find a few who are not so tall, but generally they're all tall and big size. So that's because of the history like that. Now this is to give you an understanding. For most of us, this is common knowledge, but we don't assume that everybody knows. And it is good to remind ourselves how all this came about. And so you find, therefore, people of the same surname who formed that clan, they generally are united under a clan association, the Kongsi or the Huiguan. Everywhere they go, they will gather together, and often they will meet somewhere. They will rent a place or build a building of their own. Generally, they like to build a building of their own. And then there, they will try to keep records of the clan that comes there. But with the passing of time, the newer generations do not take the trouble to do that. But in many parts of China, the clan association is still there. The bookkeeping, the ancestry of the people is still there. Yeah? You can actually go back to your ancestral village and look for the person in charge of the ancestral book, and he can trace for you. You can say who your great-grandfather was, who migrated from which part of China to which part of the world. So from the name, they can trace. And then they'll say, oh, your great-grandfather was the number what son of so-and-so, and that person has how many brothers and sisters, and so on, where they were originally from, and so on. They can tell you some stories like this. And it was of interest to me to know that, to read of this, you see, in Myanmar, in the north of Myanmar, the people were just across the border from southwest China, the Yunnan area, Kunming. Yeah, there was this person who wrote a book, this lady who wrote a book about her father, and her father came over as a child from Kunming to north of Myanmar. And then of course they settled down, they grew up there, they got absorbed into Myanmar society, and the father was quite active in politics, and along the way all the intrigues and so on. And finally, the father escaped overseas, and he left a pile of papers with this daughter to say, you must one day write out this story. And this daughter grew up busy with studies and family life. She forgot about it until in later years. She read through, she discovered to her amazement there's such a store of interesting things. So she did further research and wrote down the story of the father and the family. And then she traced back to North Myanmar, and then she went over to China side, and there she traced to the ancestral home and found out that there was this shrine, this place where the family history was kept. And she actually could see that the people of that village, many of them look quite like her, their facial features and so on. So that's very, very interesting to me. And for us who have an interest in tracing a little of your family history, you will know that this is quite unique. The family name, the name of the Chinese generally consists of three characters. There are three parts. There are exceptions which I will mention in a moment, but there are three parts. And even some Chinese younger generations need to hear this, because they are beginning to lose the understanding why their parents give them a name which consists of three parts. So the first part, the first character, is the family name. So this family name is carried on the side of the man. So the man would marry a lady in from another clan. Okay? Then the children would take on the family name of the father. Okay? So women are married out, men marry the ladies in. And what happened is that the children would be given the family name of the father, then the middle name would be the generation name, and it is taken from one character of the family poem. In every family, Chinese family, there would be a family poem. The younger generations have forgotten this and lost it. They have lost this. But if you ask your older people and trace, you will soon find that there is a family poem. And in fact, each family has two poems. It's getting a bit confusing, but let me explain. One poem is regarded as inside, one is outside. See? So let us look at the family poem, one poem. See? The poem might consist of something like 20 to 30 characters. Yeah? It might be saying that, the poem might say something like, the moon shines bright while the night is quiet. The sun will soon rise and the mountains will appear, or something like that. You see, so the Chinese characters will be there, many characters in that poem. Yeah? So the first generation would take the first character for the generation name. The person's son would take the second character. The son's son would take the third character. See? Until the whole poem is complete and then the cycle repeats itself, or they undergo a certain ceremony and then they have a new poem. But as far as I can tell, nobody would start a new poem if they would instead follow the poem until it's recycled. Yeah. Then the last name is the personal name of the person. Yeah. So it follows, therefore, that all the children in the family will have the same surname and same generation name. Then they would have their personal name. Yeah. Then what about the outer poem? The outer poem is when the person is deceased, the person dies, then on the tombstone will be inscribed his outer name. So he will have his family name, the surname, but the middle generation name is that of the outer poem. That means he's deceased, you see? So that is if the family still keep to that tradition, but otherwise they would use the name of the inner poem. Okay, yeah? So in that way, when two persons of the same surname meet, then they can determine which generation they belong to from their generation name. Like recently I went to make the banner for the conference. It turned out that one of the managers there was a Poe. So he asked in Chinese character, is it written this way? I said, yes. He said, I'm also Poe. Okay? Sometimes when spelled in Romanized way, using Roman alphabets, it looks the same, but the Chinese characters may be different because Chinese is a tonal language. So you can be Fu, like in my case, or in my dialect, I say Po. And Pao, you know, can be sound the same, but actually it's different, two different characters. So that's why he wanted to know the Chinese character. He said, the Renzi Pian and then like this, like that. I said, yes. He said, I'm also Po. I said, which part of the country are you from? He said, he's from the north. I said, oh, I'm from the south. See, the southern people, they are in close touch with one another, see. Is in the state of Johor, and we are also connected with the people in Sarawak, Sri Aman, and the Sri Aman people move on to Kuching, you see. So we are in interaction like this. But the northern people, they are from another strain. But there is a Po family association. So once in a while, they will call the Po's to come together. Then they will celebrate for whatever, any big occasion, you see. They will call as many as possible together, especially those who have done well in society. They might be very prominent politicians, prominent government officers, very prominent businessmen. They will tend to want those people to come because it's a matter of pride for the association. Yeah? And to make matters even more complicated, for our family name, we have two other family names who are regarded as brothers, see? But they are different family names. So whenever there is any clan function, the Po clan would gather together, but they would invite the Lai clan and the Lo clan because these were regarded as brothers. The history stretched back thousands of years ago when the two villages were attacked by foreigners, so they ran to the Po village in the north of China, Shanxi there, you know, next to Shantung province, you see. So the Po clan, of course, harbored them, kept them, and let them be identified as the from that village, that clan, from that family. So when things got better, in later days, their descendants always regarded one another as brothers. So whenever any of these three family names have a function, they will invite one another. Eh? And the story is that if you go to a Lai, for example, a Lai's family name, if you see the family altar and there on the there is a plaque with the Lai written, if you turn around at the back, it has the Po surname at the back. This is to say that they were once harbored by the Po.
Yeah.
But back to the main thing that you need to know, how the names come about, the family name, the generation name, and the personal name. So when I met this person, the manager of that company, he said, oh, you're of the same surname. So what is your generation name? So I mentioned my generation name, he mentioned his generation name. But he's not too sure, and I'm not too sure where we are. Is he above or below? See? So if he is higher up in a poem, then he is of higher ancestry than me. And if he's one generation above, I have to call him uncle, address him as uncle. If he's two generations above, I have to address him as granduncle. Yeah. And sometimes, one generation, one family may propagate slower than the other family. So if this family propagates faster, then a person may be many generations down the line. Then he meets a person who has propagated slower, you see, and this family that has propagated slower, the younger person meet an older person of the family who has propagated faster. But their age difference is such that, you see, by generation, the older man is lower down the generation, and he has to, rightly speaking, address the younger person who is of the older generation as uncle or granduncle. It's a bit funny. Sometimes they just address and just in a jovial way address, you know, granduncle, this and that, you see. But, you know, they take it quite for fun like that, you see. But traditionally, that was the reasoning. Huh? You know which generation you're from. So the some exceptions are this. We say generally the middle name is the generation name, but in some families the personal name is in the middle, the generation is at the end. Those are the exceptions. There are fewer families like that. Most families have the generation names in the middle. And then another thing to note is that the surname generally is just one character, generally. But there are a few surnames that are of two. For example, in our church here, there is Auntie Ivy, Situ, Situ, Ouyang. Yeah? See? There is Ouyang also. Yeah? So there are some surnames that are dual syllables. Yeah? But most surnames are just single syllables, and therefore there are three characters to the name: family name, generation name, and personal name. Yeah. And in the early days, when the Chinese migrated overseas because of war, famine, and various other reasons, they moved overseas. When they arrived at a place, they soon organized themselves. They find jobs, they struggle, they survive, and then the people of the same clan will get together, and then when any others of the same clan come, they will look for this association, the Huiguan or the Kongsi, to look for shelter there. So this new guest would generally be housed because they are family. See, then they will be helped around to find a job, and soon they settle, and they in turn in the future would help the new ones who come. See, that's how it has operated. And remember, the Chinese have spread everywhere. They are like cockroaches. Yeah? In America, you know, in the early days when they were building the railways and trying to move west, see, the Chinese were employed to work on the railways. In Australia, the gold mines, the Chinese were employed to work on the gold mines. In South Africa, and in my student days, I traveled to Norway and then hitchhiked to the northern city of Narvik. And there I found Chinese. Yes, they are everywhere. So wherever they go, somehow or other you discover there are certain things peculiar about them that are common about them. See, the culture has had an effect upon them. So one of them is the idea of the name. The moment you meet a person, you ask, you know, Ni Kui Sin, what is your surname? What is your family name? See? And if you discover the same surname, what is your generation name, where you are from, and so on. You see, you try to see how close you are related. And generally, the Chinese don't marry a person of the same surname, generally speaking. Although it is allowed from the six generations above. See? So within the six generation, that means generation one to normally say generation five, but some people include generation six, you are still regarded as close family, your brothers and sisters. And generally they refer to one another as brother or sister. Okay? So as an example, say, although this custom is slowly lost, but as an example of how it operates like this, say, some years back, my uncle, who is my father's older, eldest brother, he was brought to church, a charismatic church, by his daughter. Then, because of the strange practice of that church, or the speaker come and touch and people fell down, so my uncle was a little bit disturbed. So when he arrived home, he quietly called me and say, you know, the church was like this, like that, what do you think? Is that alright? You know, so I have to find out exactly what happened, and apparently the preacher tried to push him down, but he couldn't understand English. He didn't know he was supposed to fall down, you see. So he resisted. So everyone in the church laughed. Yeah? And finally, someone touched him and said, Uncle, you please go down. You see, in Chinese to him, so he got down, you see. So there are two catchers waiting for him to fall down when the healer touched his forehead, you see, but not knowing English, he didn't know he was supposed to fall down. So he resisted, he was pushed down, of course he resisted, you see. So people laughed, you see. So one of those waiting to catch him touched his arm and said, please go down, you see. So he quietly called me. And the way he said it is, you see, your sister brought me to church, you see, and now she's unhappy with me, you see. So I remember very significantly that's how he said it, you see. Because for the older generation, you are in the same family. We are only first cousins. We are actually first cousins. First cousins are regarded as very close, your brothers and sisters, see. So within the sixth generation, they are not allowed to intermarry. They are not allowed to marry. But beyond that, they can marry, although still frowned upon. So for example, a surname Lee and a surname Lee got married, or a surname Lim and a surname Lim got married, is generally frowned upon. The people poke fun and say, oh, so you marry within the same clan, so you don't lose out. Property is still all in the same family, see. But actually, the clan can be so big. The Lim, for example, and the Lees are very big clans, and the Wongs are very big clans, see. So it's so distant, it's hard for you to trace anymore. So generally, they allow for marriage from the sixth generation onwards. Okay, within the sixth generations, not allowed. Okay? So that's how the family name and the family, the clan comes about, and how things operate. Okay? Then to honor the family name, the honor of the family name must be preserved at all costs. In the old days, you must not bring shame on the family name. You do wrong, not only you shame yourself, you harm yourself, but you shame the whole clan. And the family should not be allowed to lose face. The concept of face is so very important in Chinese culture. And Westerners and foreigners who don't know this sometimes get into a lot of trouble. Because if you humiliate a person in public, especially, you know, they'll seek revenge. They really, you know, it's too much, you see. So they can accept deep humiliation, they can accept deep pain and deep loss. But if they are made to lose face in public, that is unforgivable, you see. And generally, they can't take it. They will really try to avenge themselves. Yeah? And it comes to the personal level as well. The person can sometimes say, please give me face, you know. So you must understand that he is quite embarrassed by the situation and he would like to settle things, but if you don't give him face and you humiliate him in public, it is something that he will bear for a long time. He's not going to easily forgive you for that, see? So if sin, from the positive point of view, we can say the Chinese have a sense of honor, they value familial ties, they are culturally rooted, which gives them a certain sense of stability. That's why there are songs, there are stories, there are things about searching your roots, yeah, and returning to your kuxiang. You see, so that concept starts a very deep note in most people. If you sing, for example, Long De Chuan Ren, you see, the descendants of the dragon, or, you know, Xiao Chen Gu Shi, you know, why is songs like this? Why it touches the heart of Chinese all over the world? Why is it? Is it the song is beautiful, or is it the words beautiful? No, it's the concept of jia xiang, this concept of your root, your family home, touched deep inside the people. So wherever you go, however far, one day, especially when you are growing older, you know, when young that time, you may say, oh, you sing old man's song, you are very China-minded, Chinese, you are typical Chinaman. So they might laugh like that, but as they grow older, they discover something in them stirs. And then songs like Xiao Chen Gu Shi and Long De Chuan Ren, the descendants of the dragon, it's the wordings, the concept, it touched them deeply, you see. It touched them on a very tender spot, see. That's why there are people who go back to trace their roots and they just like to go and see. For generations, 10 generations, they go back and see where they have been and what their history were and so on. Okay? So it's one of the peculiar characteristics of an ancient civilization, that the roots of the people come down to them and touch them very deeply like that. Then sin negatively, the Chinese can be hypocritical in keeping up a front because they want face, see? So they might be poor, for example, but poor, so they don't mind suffering in their poverty, but don't lose face. Then they put up such a front and pretend to be not too bad, you see? When in fact, to us, from the biblical point of view, that's pretending to be what you are not, you see? And then they will act inconsistently, see? They will say one thing to preserve face when in fact they are not as they are, see? And they are also driven to unreasonable vindictiveness, because when you really make them lose face and then they can't take it, they might go all out for vengeance. So all in all, you can see it from a positive aspect, from the negative aspect, you can see this is part of the Chinese culture, how it affects Chinese behavior. Now, although many young families today are not members of their clan association, and they do not follow the generation poem when giving names to their children, the sense of loyalty to their families is still very strong. And the eldest sons, in particular, must carry on the family traditions, especially when the parents pass away. They are the ones who lead the procession in the funeral and carry out the rites. So when the elder son is converted, wow, all hell breaks loose in the family and everybody will be so opposed, see. And if he's really adamant, he's like washing his hand clean, he's like, you do what you want to me, so then the second son will have to take over the responsibility, you see. So sometimes such sons would say, let me wait until my parents pass away, then I will consider the Christian faith. But of course, the challenge of the gospel is, if you are serious about being saved, then it has to be now. You can't bid your time, you can't wait at your own convenience, see? And so when the gospel challenge comes to such people, it's tremendous struggle indeed, because of such values. Okay, so that covers pietism. We come next to maxims. maxims are widely accepted rules of conduct which contain certain generally accepted truths. And these maxims, Chinese maxims, often come in the form of short, pithy sayings. Maxims bind a Chinese educated person more than it binds the non-Chinese educated person. What we mean is that an ethnic Chinese may be educated in the Chinese way. He attends a Chinese school, he knows the Chinese language, and therefore he knows the Chinese culture. He will be bound more by maxims compared to an English educated person or a person who has an education in the place where he dwells overseas. So for example, in Indonesia, he might have an Indonesian education, he speaks Indonesian, then he's less controlled by maxims. Yeah? But when they picked up Chinese and they read Chinese, they know how to memorize and quote such maxims. You discover their behavior is controlled quite a fair bit by these maxims. And such a person will have a ready-made view of things provided by these maxims, because the maxims come together as a pool of sayings, you see. And one example is, mountains can be moved, but a man's disposition cannot be changed. So if you try to witness to the person and demand that the person must repent and turn to Christ, live a new life, you see, he might be controlled by such a maxim, you see, that he will not be easily changed. He will cling on to what he holds to. This is equivalent to the English saying, where there is a will, there is a way. So the person will do things his own way. You say salvation cannot be achieved by your own effort. The person will still insist, saying that he will try all the same. You may say, I'm unable, but I will try to achieve salvation by myself, by my own effort. You see? So, you see, when you witness to a Chinese controlled by Chinese maxims, there are these values that are contained in this body of sayings, and his behavior is controlled by the maxims to such an extent that sometimes he's not aware of it. See? But, of course, we know salvation is of the Lord. When the Holy Spirit works, the hard hearts and the stubborn wills will be conquered. But when conquered, when converted, the person began to analyze things in the light of the Bible's teaching. Now the Bible's teaching stretches back not 6,000 years, but it stretches back to the beginning, when in the beginning when God created the heavens and the earth, and the first man, first woman were created. You see? So the Bible stretches even further to the beginning of everything. See? So when we begin to see things in the light of the Bible's teaching, we begin to understand why at that time the Chinese, when confronted by the gospel, has such tremendous struggle. See, not only pietism has a hold on him, but maxims have a hold on him. And of course, in terms of maxims, there are three factors that influence the emergence of such wise sayings. Firstly, the Chinese culture. The culture is long, it is an ancient culture, and it has a well-developed language. And the language is a living language, is still in use and is evolving all the time, and is not dead and static and become useless. No, it is not useless. It continues to evolve and adjust, and therefore it is what we call a living language. And as an example, we know that the Chinese are a very hardy and persevering people. Under great difficulties, they will continue, they will continue, they'll try. There are others who fail and die, but the next generation comes, they will try, they'll try. So, and this characteristic is reflected in a saying, where there is determination, even solid gold or rock can be broken. Then the second factor that influence maxim is the geographical location of the Chinese civilization. China is basically a mountainous country. If you look, you discover it's only the coastal plains and the river banks that, you know, but otherwise you discover that the mountains are cultivated, the people live in the mountains and it's a mountainous country. And therefore, you discover sayings like what we mentioned earlier, mountains can be moved, but a man's disposition cannot be changed. Then similarly, in the old days, tigers used to roam the country. So you have the story of the Wu Song attack the fight the tiger, you know, barehanded, you know, imagine this man, very powerful, Wu Song Tahu, you know, he barehandedly killed the tiger, you see. So the tiger features much in ancient, in this Chinese painting and so on. Often you see the horse and the tiger. You hardly see the lion. The lions feature in the lion dance, but tigers seems to be seen more in paintings and horses, see? And dragons and phoenix. Okay. Then the other factor that influences maxims is time. Time causes culture and geographical location of the Chinese to change, so that new sayings emerge. And these sayings are often produced by writers, and nowadays with, in the old days there's opera shows, see, nowadays there's film shows, there's YouTube, yeah? So things evolve very quickly. Yeah? And because of the background of maxims where certain truths are put in a pungent, pithy way, see? Often either in four syllables, or seven syllables, like that, you see. So you discover there will be a matching four syllable sounds, they match, you see. And similarly, when you go to a person's house, especially those of some position in society, the main entrance of the house has couplets. One side has a number of words and matched by another couplet. You know, they, so they are called couplets because they go together. See, a saying on one side and a saying on the other side. See, and they rhyme with one another. Okay. So if you go to the, such a house, you discover at the main entrance on both sides of the doors are these couplets like that. Okay. So it's because of this background, when new sayings come out, they also take on the same pattern. Generally four sound or seven sound like that. You see. Syllables, you see? And take for example the modern saying. At first it was longer. It says to hit is to show affection, to scold is to show love, you see? But with time it becomes shortened to hit is to love, okay? And all this got propagated just like in the ancient times, but now it's faster and through modern media. In the old days, remember, a book is written, the stories are told orally and spread around. There are traveling storytellers. They arrive at a village, the people gather, then they will tell stories, then the hat is passed around, then people donate and so on. See? Then the opera, the Chinese opera. The opera, we mentioned that there are different styles of opera. There's Beijing opera, there's Cantonese opera, there's also the Guangxi opera, so on. Their styles differ. So for the connoisseurs, those who enjoy these things, they can taste, they can see the differences, see? But the stories are propagated through these means. And in those days, they were pretty well organized. Everything was organized, see? Even the opera people, they form some sort of clan themselves. There are initiation rites to be accepted, and then there are rules within the troupe, opera troupe, and then the skills are taught, because along the way, when you perform opera, you have to learn how to dress, you learn how to act, the voice has to, you learn how to sing, and then there's acrobatics, you learn how to jump, and then learn how to fight, you see. So all these arts, all this knowledge has to be passed on only to members, initiated members. So in those days, things develop like that more slowly, but the culture becomes fixed like that, such that there is now a pattern. In a more fast-moving world, where there is YouTube and there is video shows, there is things propagate faster. So like modern sayings like to hit is to love, actually is spread around with time, people just accept it. But of course, every saying has to be tested from the Bible, by the Bible. So we must be very careful. Don't just quote as though that is absolute truth. How can you say simply that, you know, ta si ai, you know, that means you to hit is to love. So sometimes you apply it wrongly, you abuse. Originally it was not meant like that. Even originally the background of it might not be true. See, it's human beings coming up with ideas. So even the ancient maxims, tracing back to centuries, it came from man, you must remember. So although filtered through the centuries and tested through time, and some truths are there, some common truths are there, but still the wisdom is that of man. So bear that in mind. So however ancient the history may be, remember that everything must be tested by the truth of scripture. Now, while the Chinese maxims express the wisdom of the Chinese people, we always remember that it is the product of man and therefore can never claim absolute truth. So we come to the third influence, which is materialism. Whenever Chinese people meet, they talk about food and money. Really, you go anywhere in the world, you meet Chinese, they talk about food and money. See? Prosperity in times past was measured by the number of sons a person had, because in those days, China was an agrarian society. Agriculture was the main profession and therefore the main source of living, way of earning a living. So people have more sons, they can work hard in the fields. So today, prosperity is measured by how much money a person earns and how much property he has and how well he eats. Yeah, so eat well. They are constantly advised to eat well, you see. If you are a person who is earning well, you should be eating well. Yeah. And materialism constitutes a hindrance, because the average Chinese seeks after material wealth and has no time to seek to know God. It's just simply too busy earning a living. And to them, living the Christian life is time-consuming. You have to go to church, you have to do this, you have to do that. See? And furthermore, a Christian, becoming a Christian would mean that you now cannot carry out the occasional corrupt practice to become rich quickly. In order to be rich quickly, you have to engage in shortcuts that are not morally correct, then that might be legally wrong as well. It might break the law. Yeah. So corruption and cheating comes along the way. See? So those who want to get rich quick, they resort to lying and cheating. Now, of course, in saying all this, we must note that we don't despise what has been handed down to us totally. We are just being honest and assess our culture, and we don't want to paint everything as rosy and good. We being honest means that we point out the negative effects upon us as well. But we really appreciate the fact that our ancestors, they led a hard life, and often because of their frugality, because of their hard work, their perseverance and their suffering, see, they want the next generation to be better, then the next generation to be better. See? They are prepared to sacrifice for the future generation. See? So today we enjoy the fruit of it. See? But on our part, we can't just say, oh, we are better off now, therefore we continue to behave like that. No. If a practice is not right or not good, we mustn't follow, see? And especially being materialistic. If we are better off, do we remain unsatisfied and continue to want to accumulate more and continue to want to be richer, as though we can't run away from the this fact that we are materialistic, we can't change, therefore forever we are trying to accumulate more. And we really have to take stock of ourselves. And when we come to the Bible, we come to realize that of course hard work is encouraged, But on the other hand, greed is idolatry and condemned by God. Colossians chapter 3, verse 5. And the Bible warns us in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 10, money is that this teaching is that money in itself is not evil, but it is the love of money which is a root of all kinds of evil. It's not the only root, it is a root. It is one root among many. But from that one root, namely the love of money, it is a root of all kinds of evil. Many evils flow out of that. And Matthew 6:31-33, remember 6:33, it tells us that we have to seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all else that we need in life will be added to us. So we have looked at the three powerful influences upon the character and behavior of the Chinese: pietism, maxims, and materialism. Let us sum up the matter. We take note that all three hindrances are present in the Chinese to varying degrees. Pietism is stronger in the Chinese who is aware of it, understands it, and is proud of his heritage. Some are not bothered. Some, their upbringing and their education is such that they are not taught, they are not taught the values, Chinese values. There are people today laugh at such, calling them bananas. Outwardly they look Chinese, that means they are yellow skin. Inwardly they are white, they think more like a Westerner. See? Then when we, to poke fun at one another, that is okay. But if we are really overly Westernized inside, when you interact with the Chinese, you discover they find it very hard to accept a person who does not appreciate Chinese culture totally. They find it very strange, you know. See? So when you are treated as a banana, instead of being poked fun at, they really seriously look upon you as a banana. They are not too pleased with you. They avoid you because of your Western ways. See? When outwardly you are Chinese, see? Then it is not so good, because you want to bear good witness. You really have to understand who you are living with, who we are interacting with. So pietism is stronger in those who are aware of it, understand it, and is proud of his heritage. Maxims bind the Chinese educated more than others. So when you are Chinese educated, be very careful, because there's this ready pool of ideas which you subconsciously think is actually absolutely true, when in fact it's not. It's human wisdom, see? And although passed down for so long, and although, you know, it has been in the culture for so long, doesn't mean that it is on the same level as divine truth. So we must come to understand that when converted, we do not want anymore to be controlled more by maxims. Maxims are there. It's what is right and good we can keep and value as part of our culture. But what controls our life should be the Bible. The Bible is our only authority in all matters of faith and practice. So for those of this category who are Chinese educated, and along the way you unconsciously are being controlled by maxims, any situation you come up with a saying, as though that ends the story, that ends the argument, then you have to be very careful. You have to really learn to be immersed more in the Bible's teaching, memorize more the verses of the Bible, and learn to submit your life more to the values of the Bible. Then materialism is the strongest in any Chinese who is not converted. A person who is not converted, generally speaking, they are taught from early to earn money, earn money, earn money, earn money. See? And some of you have heard the story that, see, when I resigned from my job at the university to become full-time pastor, my parents were very upset, and the word got around to the relatives. And one day I was summoned up by an aunt and her husband, and just in front of them they gave me a lecture. See? Oh, you were raised up by your parents, you know. They spend so much effort and time giving you an education and you disappoint them, eh? See? And when my, of course, when my parents first heard about it, they came, yeah? And they were very sad, you see. And my mother used the words, gong kia, beyao tan bi, stupid son, you don't know how to earn money. You're giving up your studies, you're giving up your position. You can't earn money. So that's the way they think, you see. You can't earn money. You don't know how to earn money. So like money is everything to them. Everything is measured by how well you earn, you see. And again, when converted, be very careful, you see. That is still very strong in many people. So you're grabbing, wanting more, you see. You're not satisfied and you use material prosperity as a measure of the success of the person, and that's not good, it's not right. See, there are many other things that are the measure of a person's life than just material prosperity. Okay, yeah? Then take note that pietism shows the Chinese clinging to the traditions of men. Maxims show him to be worldly wise and self-righteous. Materialism shows him to be covetous and loving the things of this world. In other words, the Chinese is no different from any other people in the world. All are different physically, but all are the same in nature or by nature. All are sinners in the sight of God. All need the Savior. The Chinese do need the Lord Jesus Christ for salvation. Okay. So, we look at the questions there. Question number one, when approached by a Christian, what are the common objections raised by the non-Christian if he's bound by pietism, B, maxims, and C, materialism? How would you answer his objections? And second question, Christians are in a sense also bound by maxims, namely the teachings of the Bible. Is there any value in memorizing Bible verses and using them when witnessing to the Chinese?